Today we're doing a bit of a, well, it's a two-for-one special on this deep dive.
Yeah, a massive two for one.
Right, because we are looking at David Hume. And we're pulling from a brilliant lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy.
Specifically, his lectures covering Hume's major works.
Exactly. So the dialogues concerning natural religion, the natural history of religion, and his big texts on ethics, like the Treatise of Human Nature.
Right.
And to really get why this matters to you listening right now, you kind of have to understand the vibe of the 18th century.
Oh, the Age of
The
Reason.
Age of Reason, yeah. It was this very polite, orderly dinner party of an era. Everyone sort of agreed that logic was the absolute path to truth.
Yeah, you had John Locke and the rationalists basically saying that if you just, thought hard enough,
Right, just do the math in your head.
exactly, you could logically prove God exists
Yeah.
and you could prove morality is just as objective as geometry. It was a very comfortable time to be a philosopher.
The world made sense, it was
Life
structured.
is perfectly structured.
And then David Hume walks into the room and just flips the table entirely.
He really did. I mean, what stands out in Dr. Holmes's breakdown isn't just that Hume was a skeptic, it's that he was a demolitionist.
Yeah.
He didn't just disagree with the arguments for God or ethics.
Yeah.
He completely dismantled the machinery used to build those arguments.
He's the moment in Western thought where we pivot,
Yeah.
right, from asking, what is the logical proof for this, to asking, wait, how does the human mind actually work?
That's it exactly.
Yeah.
He shifts the entire ground from logic over to psychology.
And the thread connecting all of his work, the religion, the ethics, it's this idea that we aren't these pure rational
Right,
angels.
we are creatures of habit and feeling.
So let's start with the religion piece, because this is where he really goes after the
Or
establishment.
he goes right for the jugular.
Right. In the 18th century, the big thing was natural theology,
Yeah.
which, just to clarify, this wasn't belief because the Bible says so. This was belief because logic says so.
Right. The most famous version of this was the teleological argument, or the argument from design.
The classic watchmaker analogy.
Exactly.
You know, you walk down a beach, you find a pocket watch, you see the gears, the springs, the
You
complexity.
don't assume the ocean just washed it up by accident.
Right. You assume an intelligence made it. Therefore, when you look at the universe, which is way more complex than a watch, you just logically have to assume a universe maker.
It's a very compelling argument. I mean, it feels intuitive.
It does.
But in his dialogues concerning natural religion, Hume just tears this analogy apart.
And he does this through a conversation between three characters, right?
Yeah, he sets it up as a dialogue between a skeptic, a Lockean who loves logic, and a Platonic mystic. And through the skeptic, Hume brings in what's called his copy principle.
Okay, right. This is the epistemological heavy lifting.
Yeah, the copy principle is basically his rule that all our ideas are just faint copies of impressions.
Meaning things we've actually seen or felt.
Precisely. For Hume, if you can't trace an idea back to a sensory impression, that idea is suspect.
Got it.
So Dr. Holmes uses this great example from the text. If you see a half-built house,
You infer a builder.
right. Why? Because we've seen houses being built. We have a whole bank of sensory impressions of men with hammers, blueprints, scaffolding.
We've literally seen the cause and the effect together.
Exactly. We have a constant conjunction between the object and the maker.
And here's the trap. We don't have that with the universe.
We do not. The universe is a totally unique effect.
No.
We have never seen a universe being built.
We don't have a universe factory we can go visit.
Right. We can't establish that causal link. So when we say the universe is like a house, so it must have a builder, Hume argues we're making a massive leap that logic just doesn't
It's a
support.
false analogy.
Completely. We're taking a concept from our tiny localized human experience building stuff and pasting it onto the entire cosmos.
And he goes even further than that, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. He says, even if you grant the analogy, it doesn't get you to the Christian God.
Because if the universe is like a house, well, houses are usually built by teams of people.
Exactly. So why not many gods? Polytheism.
Or houses are sometimes built by terrible contractors who botched the job.
Right. So maybe this universe is just a botched attempt by an infant deity.
A rude draft, I think he calls it. Like some
Yeah.
junior god made this world and then just abandoned it because it was so bad.
He's showing that once you step away from strict experience,
Yeah.
logic can take you anywhere.
You can't prove the specific attributes of God, like infinity or perfection, just by looking at a tree.
You really can't.
So wait, if the logic fails and all these classical proofs crumble, does Hume conclude that we should all just be atheists?
You would think so.
Because that seems like the inevitable drop-off point.
It does, but Dr. Holmes is very careful here. Hume isn't saying God doesn't exist. He's saying logic can't take you there.
Okay.
But, and this is the crucial Humina twist, nature is stronger than principle.
Ah, the distinction between abstruse philosophy and practical life.
Exactly. We might sit in a study and logically doubt everything, but the moment we walk outside, we can't help but believe.
Right, the orderedness of nature strikes us. It leaves an impression on us.
Yes. We are psychologically wired to see agency and order. We don't believe because of a math equation. We believe because of a feeling.
A sentiment.
A sentiment, exactly.
It's almost like he's saying belief is a survival mechanism, or at least a psychological inevitability.
Which perfectly bridges us to his other work, The Natural History of Religion.
Right. Because if belief is psychological, not logical, then it has to have an evolutionary history.
It evolves as our psychology encounters the world.
And his theory on this is just fascinating. He argues that the original religion of humanity wasn't monotheism. It was polytheism.
Yes.
And he bases this entirely on human fear and hope.
Right. Think about early humans. They lived in a terrifying, chaotic world. Storms, famine, disease. They had very diverse fears and diverse hopes.
So psychologically, it makes no sense for a primitive mind to attribute all that random chaos to one single perfect being.
It's way too abstract. If I need rain, I want a rain god.
Right. If I want to win a war, I want a war god. I need specialists.
You need immediate agents for immediate problems.
Yeah.
That is polytheism. It's the natural state of the anxious human mind.
But then it shifts.
It shifts. Hume says as society stabilizes and people become more contemplative, we start to notice the unity of nature.
We see that the rain feeds the crops, which feeds the soldiers.
Right. It's all one system. So we start to rationalize our way toward monotheism. We start worshiping one creator.
But there's a catch here, isn't there?
A huge catch. And it's such a brilliant insight into human nature. Monotheism is a rational conception. It's abstract. It implies a God who is unchanging and perfect and distant.
And the human imagination just struggles with that.
It really does. It's almost too boring for us.
We crave the drama. We crave the connection.
The perfect God is too far away. So Hume argues there's this constant flux in religion. We reach monotheism because we want to be rational.
But then we slide back toward polytheism because we need to feel something.
Exactly. This is what Dr. Holmes calls the cycle of secular polytheism.
I love this concept because even if we claim to be monotheists or even atheists, we start elevating intermediate powers.
We create new idols.
Yeah.
Holmes points out that when the connection to the divine snaps, we don't just stare at a blank wall.
No, we start worshiping money, power, sex, celebrities.
These become the new gods that govern our everyday fears and hopes.
It's the exact same psychological machinery as the rain god, just with different branding.
It really is. And Hume even notes that for monotheism to actually survive this flux, it usually has to introduce something like the incarnation.
Like in Christianity, the idea of God becoming human, walking in history, suffering.
Yes. It grounds the abstract back into the concrete. It gives the human imagination a story to hold on to.
Because for Hume, stories and feelings are what drive us, not abstract proofs.
Never the abstract proofs.
So, okay, if we can't trust reason to get us to God, what about morality?
The hot issue of the 18th century.
Right, because the rationalists of his day, like Locke, were claiming that ethics was literally just like math?
Locke's view was very straightforward. If you define property and you define theft as the violation of property, then logically, theft is inconsistent with property.
It's a tautology.
Right, he called it a relation of ideas. You can prove theft is wrong the same way you prove 2 + 2 = 4.
But Hume says that's a trick.
A total trick. Hume argues that reason deals with only two things. Relations of ideas, like definitions in math, and matters of fact, which is just describing what is happening.
So logic can tell you what happened. It can say John took the bread.
Right.
But it can't tell you that John was wrong.
This brings us to his most famous contribution to ethics, the is-ought gap.
Yes, explain this, because this is massive.
Hume basically argues that you can stack up all the facts in the world, all the I.S. statements, the man is dead, the knife is in his back, the other man held the knife.
Just piling up the facts.
Pile them up to the moon. But no matter how many facts you have, you can never logically deduce an ought. You cannot deduce he ought not to have done that.
Because ought isn't a fact about the physical world. It's a judgment.
It's a value. And reason, according to Hume, deals only with facts. Reason is completely inert.
That doesn't care.
It doesn't care at all. It can show you the most efficient way to rob a bank just as easily as it can show you the best way to run a charity. It has no preference.
Which leads to that quote that usually scares everyone. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions.
Yeah. People hear the word slave and think he's saying we're just animals running on blind impulse.
Right.
But Hume means slave in the sense of a navigator. The passions, our desires, our feelings, our sentiments, they set the destination.
And reason just steers the ship.
Exactly. If you don't already desire the well-being of your neighbor, logic is never going to give you a reason to help them.
Wow. So if logic is just the GPS, what is the engine? Like, if I say murder is wrong, what am I actually doing in Hume's view?
You're expressing a sentiment. You are essentially saying, the idea of murder gives me a feeling of disapproval.
So it's subjectivism. Morality is felt, not logically judged.
Exactly.
But hold on. If morality is just, I feel this is wrong, doesn't that dissolve into total relativism?
That is the terrifying precipice Hume stands on.
Because if I feel murder is fun and you feel it's wrong, is it just a matter of taste? Like you prefer vanilla and I prefer chocolate.
And that's exactly what his critics accused him of. But he steps back from that edge by appealing to nature. Hume is an ethical naturalist.
Meaning what exactly?
He argues that while morality is based on feeling, human feelings aren't just random. We're all cut from the same cloth.
We share a common human nature, a shared psychological structure.
Yes. And the mechanism that keeps us from all just being relativist sociopaths is what he calls sympathy.
Now, we have to be careful here, right? Because sympathy today just means feeling sorry for someone.
Right, sending a Hallmark card. That's not what Hume means. He means it as a literal mechanical resonance.
Like two strings on a violin.
That is the perfect metaphor. If you pluck one string, the other one vibrates. Because we share a common nature, when I see you in pain, the string of pain vibrates in me.
I naturally see the resemblance between you and me.
Yes. You literally receive their passion. It's a contagion of feeling. And because I experience a version of your pain, I naturally disapprove of whatever action caused it.
So benevolence, just wishing good for others, isn't a command from God, and it's not a logical calculation. No. It's a reflex.
It's a natural virtue. We approve of kindness because it pleases our sense of sympathy. We disapprove of cruelty because it grates against it.
But what about the stuff that doesn't trigger that immediate emotional vibration?
What do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking about things like justice or property rights or obeying the speed limit. I don't feel a deep vibrating sympathy for my neighbor's property line.
No. And Hume would say you absolutely shouldn't expect to. This is where he makes a really important distinction between natural virtues like kindness and artificial virtues.
Artificial meaning man-made.
Yes. Hume argues that justice is an invention. It's a tool for utility.
Okay, break that down for me.
Think about it this way. If we lived in a world of unlimited abundance where rivers flowed with wine and food just fell from the sky, would we need laws against theft?
No, because you could just grab more. Theft wouldn't even mean anything.
Exactly. And on the flip side, if we were all perfectly benevolent angels who love strangers just as much as we loved ourselves, would we need contracts?
No, because we'd always just share everything anyway.
Right. So justice only arises because we are in a middle state.
We have limited generosity.
Yeah.
We like our own families more than we like strangers.
And we have limited resources.
Yeah.
Scarcity. Because of that friction, we have to invent the rules of justice.
We invent property. We invent rights.
We do. There are no natural rights in Hume's world. Unlike Locke, there is only utility.
And Dr. Holmes outlines the three laws of nature as artifacts here, right?
Yes. The stability of possession, which is property, the transfer by consent, which is commerce, and the keeping of promises, which is contracts.
And we invented these simply because without them, we have war.
Exactly. We realized through harsh experience that if we don't respect property, we get chaos. If we don't keep promises, society collapses.
So we follow the rules not because they're divine and not because they are mathematically true.
We follow them because they work. It's purely pragmatic.
It's really the foundation of utilitarianism.
It absolutely is. We learn that these artificial rules preserve the stability of society. We approve of justice not because we inherently love the law, but because we love the peace it brings.
It's honestly impressive how consistent he is across the board.
He really is.
Religion is a psychological response to fear and hope. Morality is a psychological response to sympathy. Justice is a psychological response to utility.
He sweeps the entire board clean of metaphysics.
He forces a massive cleanup operation in philosophy.
Oh, he completely forced a reset. Mm-hmm. After Hume, you couldn't just do philosophy the old way. You couldn't just assume God exists or that rights are self-evident.
You had to deal with the fact that these might just be projections of your own mind.
It woke Immanuel Kant up, didn't it?
Yeah, woke him from his dogmatic slumber, as Kant famously put it.
Kant realized he couldn't beat Hume on the logic. He agreed with Hume that you cannot logically prove God.
So Kant had to go logically reconstruct ethics just to find a moral argument to get back to God.
But the damage, or the liberation, depending on how you look at it, was already done.
It really changes the way we look at our own convictions. We like to think we hold our values because we've thought them through.
That we're rational agents operating on pure facts.
And Hume just holds up a mirror and says, no, you are feeling creatures. You are driven by habit, custom, and sentiment.
Which is humbling.
It is. And it leads to the big question I want to leave everyone listening with today.
Go for it.
Hume suggests that our deepest beliefs, God, morality, justice, aren't truths we discovered out there in the universe. They are habits we formed in here in our psychology just to help us survive together.
It makes them feel incredibly fragile, but also incredibly human.
That's the rub. Does knowing your values are actually just feelings make them less real? Or does the fact that we all share those feelings, that the strings vibrate in all of us, make them more real than any logical proof ever could?
It's a question that basically defines the modern world.
It really is. Well, thanks for deep diving with us today. We'll see you next time.